Welcome to Conversations for a Brave New World with Donna, Sonia, and Cliff, where we bring you a global, national, and local focus on gender, sexuality, and feminism.
Good afternoon. I'm Donna Bridges, Senior Lecturer at Charles Sturt University, and today we're discussing the problem of precarious employment in higher education and the burden this has on women particularly. Precarious work is an escalating trend in the Australian workforce and one that contributes to employment insecurity, income inadequacy, and a lack of employment rights and protections. In the university system, it is a problem that impacts unfairly on women. I'm here with a group of researchers from Charles Sturt who have investigated this problem. They are Emma Rush, Sarah Redshaw, Elizabeth Wool, and Larissa Bambury. Thanks for being here with us today. I'm going to start by asking Emma a question. Emma, can you first tell us what is the extent of precarious work in universities in Australia and particularly at CSU?
Academic work, that is teaching and research work in Australian universities, is now primarily completed by precariously employed staff, so that's fixed term and casually employed staff. It's actually more difficult than you might expect to get clear data on this because in Australian universities, work is divided between academic work, the teaching and the research, and administrative and what's called professional and general work, which is administrative work, groundspeople, all of the many other things required to make a university run. And precarious work occurs across both domains, so it's often quite difficult to get the figures separated out, specifically covering academic work. The best combined data that we could find was from a 2018 report by the National Tertiary Education Union. The National Tertiary Education Union, or the NTEU, is the union that exclusively covers the higher education sector. This report from the National Tertiary Education Union used combined data from 2016, which showed that 57% of work, teaching and research work in Australian universities was undertaken by precariously employed staff. Our expectation is that that would be considerably greater now. And in both of those categories, research and teaching, women outnumbered men in both precarious teaching work and precarious research work across Australia. The stereotypical university teacher or professor we see in movies of male professor with the jacket, with the leather elbow patches, you know, that kind of old-fashioned 1970s look, permanently employed, you know, tenured, that is not the reality in Australian higher education today. The stereotypical higher education worker is a woman who is precariously employed.
You all recently completed a study about precarious work, gender issues, and the Australian university system. In that study, you found quite a strong link between the neoliberal university and gender inequality and precarious work. Sarah, could you tell us a bit about this neoliberal university?
Well, in terms of neoliberalism, that's the drive towards a university operating as a business. And, you know, fees came in, that people are paying fees to go to university. There's, you know, the university's opened up to a broader sector of the population, so a lot more women attending universities. And at the same time, it's this business way of operating at a university. And it means that when you're always looking for the cheapest way to operate, and of course, you know, there are going to be budgetary parameters, whatever happens, but if the best way you can do it is to cut down on the cost of the teaching by employing people on contracts where they don't know where they're next going to work, that seems a very bad way to approach a business anyway.
Well, problems definitely seem to arise when we approach an education system as though it is an institution that can create a profit. While this is all going on, the universities trying to create a profit and employing people precariously and employing mostly women as precarious workers, they're also attempting to become exemplary employers of women through citations such as WGEA's Employer of Choice for Gender Equity. And yet precariously employed women don't get given opportunities for advancement. We hear that they get stuck at the bottom rung and that this isn't addressed as a gender equity issue. Elizabeth, as a precariously employed academic yourself, can you tell us how you're closed out of the usual opportunities, opportunities given to women who are permanently employed?
Yes, of course. Thanks, Donna. Well, ultimately, anyone employed casually, contractually in the way that I am is excluded from the life of the school and quite a lot of school activities. So that means attendance to meetings, any mentoring. There's no real mentoring or professional development, and there's no paid hours for administrative work, such as meetings or even attending seminars. The other way casuals are excluded if they don't have follow-on contracts is that after a certain time, and it isn't very long, they will be shut out of the university system. So they won't have access to their email, to the library, until they actually gain another contract. So there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing.
And Elizabeth, how long are those contracts usually for?
They're based on a semester, which is 3 months usually. If a casual receives research work, which is another kind of contract, it's not considered an academic contract, that will be based on the life of the project, which, and usually they're not full-time contracts, they're part-time work, sometimes as little as a day a week, sometimes as much as 3 days a week, and they might go for a year depending on the length of the project that's been won by a permanent academic.
And during one of those semesters, have you got any idea whether you'll be getting work in the next semester?
Well, I have heard that some schools have a very good organisational process where they can actually advise their casuals of work for an entire year. That hasn't happened in my experience. I've had the experience where I felt lucky enough to know if I was getting work one or two semesters in a row, and I have also been in the position where it's been 2 weeks before the new semester and I have not been contacted about any work. So it makes for a very volatile situation financially. If you don't have a reserve, if you're not one of those women who's employed flexibly, which is a misconception about precarious work. Precarious work is not flexible work.
Well, thanks, Elizabeth. That certainly sounds like unsustainable employment. During a seminar recently about gender equity in the higher education system, a vice chancellor was quoted as saying that women like being precariously employed because they can take time off to be with family, to care for elderly parents, and quite frankly, quote, go off and read a book and paint and swim in the ocean. So as a precariously employed academic yourself, Sarah, how would you say that flexible work is quite different to precarious work?
Yes, well, flexible work is what we should all have, whatever kind of employment we're in, because most people do have families and people that they care for. But yes, that's quite different to precarious work where you don't know what's coming next. And I've been in academia for, well, pretty much 40 years. And I have the longest contract I've had is 3 years. That was such luxury. But at times it's been, 20 hours here and 30 hours there, and does make life very difficult and stressful when you do good work, you know that your work is appreciated.
Thanks, Sarah. And I know as somebody who's permanently employed that flexible work for myself means I could get in at 10 in the morning and knock off at 6 at night. I could work on the weekend if I wanted to have time off during the week. So a very different arrangement to precarious work, isn't it? And Emma, adding to this problem of the unsustainability of employment. Universities have actually been found to underpay casual staff, and the National Tertiary Education Union recovered a massive $3 million in underpayments in the last 3 years. How does it happen that precariously employed staff get underpaid?
I think it was actually probably more than 3 million, because at Charles Sturt University alone, 4.7 million was found to be owing to casual staff over the previous 7 years. So the situation is very bad in higher education. And well, might you ask, how are these staff so badly underpaid? The process of employing academic staff is complex because there are different salary rates for different kinds of teaching. There's a different rate for marking. And frequently staff are not given all of the payment they are entitled to. So it's a somewhat chaotic system that has developed historically from a time when most staff were permanent and there were some casual staff on the side picking up the fluctuations from year to year, to a state now where the majority actually of staff are precariously employed. And that puts a lot of work on the university to get the contracts drawn up correctly. And that hasn't, as we see, always happened. When that doesn't happen, staff who are employed insecurely are very unlikely to speak up and claim their rights, because if they do so, they're worried that they won't receive the next contract. I myself have seen situations in my own school in the past where staff who have spoken up and asked for something, even asked for an office on campus because they were teaching on campus, just access to an office, access to a computer, were not then given work in the next session, despite having taught well for years for that school. So it's not just that insecure staff are worried about not receiving future work. It's that in many cases, they've either had that happen to them themselves or they've seen it happen to colleagues.
But there are laws that protect workers, aren't there, Larissa? So why are we talking to academic university staff that have been working precariously in the university system for years and have never had their employment converted to full-time ongoing positions?
There are laws. We have the Fair Work Act, which has a number of provisions that explicitly address casual employees, but they're primarily around access to parental leave and some more general sort of provisions in the legislation that allow for casual workers to be appointed to full-time permanent ongoing positions. However, most of those, the legislative requirements actually explicitly state that somebody has to be working for a full year as a worker before they're eligible to be made permanent. And a lot of the contracts in the higher education sector in particular are designed explicitly to avoid that rule, to avoid the fact that workers are entitled to become permanent staff members after 12 months. So most of the contracts for teaching projects are 12 or 16 week contracts for sessional workers. There are also some provisions in our enterprise agreement, and all of the universities in Australia have an enterprise agreement that covers work expressly in that particular university. And there are provisions in the enterprise agreements that are stronger, if you like, than the basic provisions that are applied in the Fair Work Act. So out of the enterprise agreement, we have provisions to encourage ongoing staff members, ongoing casual workers to be made permanent. However, at the moment, those provisions are fairly weak. So I think there's an acknowledgement that universities are always going to have a level of variability in their workflows, which requires some level of casual or short-term contracts. But there are more humane ways of managing that than is currently being done.
There is a perception that casual workers who work hard and gain a good reputation as a university teacher or as a researcher will be selected for permanent employment, and maybe when somebody else leaves. But Elizabeth, that hasn't been your experience, has it?
No, that hasn't been my experience. I have heard that it happens as a pathway for casuals or sessionals in other universities and even in other schools at CSU, but it's certainly not a pathway that's been available to me in my school. And the reason that I've been given for that is entirely budgetary. So back to that neoliberal university model.
No, so what advice would you give to another precarious worker just starting off in the university sector?
What, apart from don't do it? Well, I would say cast your net widely. Get some teaching experience, keep up with your publications, get your research underway, and keep an eye on those very rare positions that do come available and go for them, because the casual pathway is so precarious in terms of translating into a full-time position, you might as well only do the casual work, the teaching and the research part-time.
Thanks, Elizabeth. And Sarah, what advice would you give precariously employed academics?
I think it is important that people who are casual insert themselves into the school or wherever they are as much as they can, so that and keep reminding the people that they're working with that they are looking for ongoing work. They are wanting to continue to work, that they bring their work to the notice of those who are in decision-making positions in their school and and other parts of the university where they can.
What advice would you have, Emma, for anybody who is precariously employed as an academic in the university system at the moment?
The system is set up really poorly. I'd like to talk about what's happening at other universities in terms of decasualisation. In response to the tsunami of precariously employed work across Australian universities at the moment, the National Tertiary Education Union has been pushing for what's called decasualisation at universities around the country in the latest enterprise bargaining round. And there's been some successes there. So most obviously, I think at places like Western Sydney University, where an agreement was reached to create 200 ongoing positions, for which the currently precariously employed workers at Western Sydney University would be the first pick. That's a huge step forward for those people, and for the people who get those new positions, that will be life-changing for them. We're also seeing, at places like the University of Melbourne, they're now trying to appoint from next year all teaching staff on fixed term rather than casual contracts. That, in many ways, addresses the issue of underpayment, because you're not having to break up just the little bits of work that you want the casual staff member to do. You're giving them a fixed term, full-time position, which then should have enough give in it to cover all the different things that one needs to do as an academic staff member. So we're seeing some positive developments in the sector, driven by the union.
Thanks, Emma. And Larissa, what advice would you have for university leadership?
So my advice for management would be that we have to stop looking at casual work on a contingent basis, on a short-term level, that we need to actually think about what are the core functions of the university, the core business of the university, and ensure that there are permanent positions that really are meaningful and useful to bring staff into.
I'm now joined by my co-host Cliff to discuss this matter further. So 50 to 80% of undergraduate teaching in Australia is now done by casual or sessional staff. These are surprising statistics, Cliff. I've now fact-checked, and there have been disputes in universities across the country about the underpayment of casual staff. And Emma's right, the estimates are much higher than I originally said. They are more like $100 million across the sector.
Well, but there are changes coming, and there is hope, isn't there, Donna, with the announcement by a lot of universities recently who are trying to move their casual staff onto full-time contracts.
That's right. Monash has announced 450 fixed-term roles for current PhD students in the last week, and Charles Sturt University has announced 60 to 70 casual conversions across the university. So given we have so many people teaching casually, this won't make a huge dent, but it's going to be meaningful, very meaningful for that 60 to 70 people.
Definitely. And also taking on board the point that not everyone wants to have a full-time job. That's not to say that people don't want a full-time continuing job. But I remember as a PhD student, having a casual contract was really useful in helping me supplement my income, because the stipend you get for a PhD is really not that much to live off completely. It also allowed me to build skills that I could use in my future academic career. So it did provide a lot of training for me as a young academic. But my case, I do acknowledge, is quite unique. It was casualization work for me at that point in time, but it would not be something I could sustain myself with currently.
That's right, Cliff. The apprenticeship model in universities was always that the PhD student who's receiving a small stipend would get some teaching work, and that teaching work would be paid casually. The problem is, over the last 20 years or even longer, PhD students haven't been transitioning into full-time work. They've been staying in the casual role. And the casual role in universities is harsh because it's not an ongoing casual role. It is a role that is available to the person for a semester, and they often don't know if they're going to get work for the next semester. But their skill base is that they teach university, that they do research. So they're hopping from casual contract to casual contract. Some of those contracts are teaching, and some of those contracts are research.
And ultimately, I think, Donna, it makes better sense for universities to think about transitioning casual staff over. When we think about contract to contract, it doesn't give casual staff the ability to design content, engage with content, and build on content in each session if you do not actually know if you're going to teach that same subject the next session. As a research institution, it doesn't give them the ability to contribute to research knowledge in Australia on an ongoing basis. And that, again, has impacts for us as a nation, largely, I would think, in terms of the quality of education we provide our graduates and also the quality of research we develop as institutions.
That's right. We want the best people teaching our students in universities, and oftentimes people are trying to get out of the sector. But having said all that, Cliff, this is the first time in a decade that we've had any hope for employment in the sector. So let's see where it takes us. Thanks for being with us today, everybody. And our next episode will be hosted by Cliff. So, Cliff, perhaps you could tell us a little bit about that.
So our next episode will be in June, and June is traditionally Pride Month, when the first Mardi Gras ever in the world happened in San Francisco in the US. So we'll be looking at where we've come, how far we've gone in LGBTQ rights in Australia, and still what needs to be done for a future that's more inclusive, where people can be themselves as they are and feel welcome and like they belong.
Great. Thanks, Cliff. Well, see you then.
Thank you for listening. This show is brought to you by the Gender Network. To get involved or find out more, simply Google the Gender Network at Charles Sturt.